Now will you turn with me to the book of Judges and to this somewhat perplexing and certainly difficult story in which there are lessons for us to learn. Some time ago I had to speak at our ministers' conference at Crieff, and it's never easy to speak to ministers, and the subject I was given was preaching. And I was pointing out to my fellow ministers, those older and younger than myself, that a sermon ought to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that the three parts should come in that order. But contrary to my advice to my fellow ministers, I want to point out to you really tonight what is the end of the sermon. That's before I start to preach it. Because we end up, at least I hope we'll end up, seeing this man Barak in terms of what he had been and what he had accomplished. But over against that, we are left with the feeling of what he could have been and what he could have done in the service of God had he not been a man who for so many years in his life had slipped away from real spiritual commitment to God. So we have the contrast and what he accomplished, and that was quite something. But think of what he could have been. And of course, prompted by the Spirit of God, we must ourselves think of what we are, what we have done, what we are doing now in the service of God and of His Christ and of the Gospel, and what we could be. And it may very well be that what God is wanting to say to us all tonight is that we are operating on a far lower spiritual level and a far more restricted level and area of service than we ought to be. But now we go back to the beginning of the sermon. And we remind ourselves, and I'm aware there are folk here tonight who weren't here the past two or three Sunday evenings. In our first three studies in the book of Judges, we have seen that when God's people, that is the people of Israel, redeemed and saved by His grace, when God's people grow careless and complacent and backslide, then inevitably there are consequences and complications. On an individual level, on a social level, on a national level. And there's a thought, we might consider that the predicament of our own nation and the condition of our own nation at this time may be directly the consequence of the fact that the Church of Jesus Christ within our land has not been true and faithful to its calling to proclaim the gospel. There are consequences and complications individually, socially, nationally, and also in relation to the church, that is, in relation to the people and the work of God. And consequences that are set in motion by the wrongness of the people of God are complications that are not easily and not lightly put right. And they are certainly not immediately put right. The pattern that we have seen, and we saw this very clearly last Sunday evening, if I remember rightly, is that the people of God, we're talking about those in our language who profess to be Christians, the people forgot God. He either slipped out of their thinking, or he was pushed out of their thinking. they forgot God. In direct consequence, they forsook God. And they moved themselves and their families and their lives further and further away from God. And in inevitable consequence, so said the chapter, the third chapter of Judges, they served Baal. They served the false gods and became participants in all the grossness and ugliness of that particular kind of idolatrous religion, not least in that they began to give their daughters to pagans to be married, and their sons took pagan daughters to be married. And through these intermarriages, they set in motion a spiritual blight upon the nation for the next generation and the generation after that. Very, very solemn. The trouble is that we are so preoccupied with ourselves, Christians though we be, that we tend only to think of how sins or this or that affect us. But then you see they affect our children. And our children's children after that. The trouble is, and I'm aware of it as I preach this kind of sermon, the trouble is that even when adrift from God, even when casual and reluctant in service, Christians still tend to think of themselves as the people of God. Oh, well, but we are Christians, so they say. Sound in doctrine and sometimes regular in worship. But is it not true that very often we are like those described in Paul's letter to Timothy, that we have a form of godliness, we have the appearance of spirituality, but denying the power of it? And the truth is that when spiritual life is a series of fairly radical fluctuations, sometimes tremendously dedicated and enthusiastic, nothing's a bother for the Lord and for His church and for His service, and at other times a flatness of mind and heart to such an extent, and I see it quite often, I look down from the pulpit and I see Christian people standing with their hymn books in their hands, and their faces are as long as fiddles, and they're not the slightest bit interested. Now you see, if Christian life is this kind of manic thing, there is something wrong. And it means very possibly that we are not listening to God. Did you notice in the opening prayer we spoke about how we can hear the word of God but not listen to it? And what I'm describing is a situation in which we are very possibly not listening to God and not learning from God, because God is always speaking. He really is. And He's speaking tonight, and He's going to speak more tonight. But He speaks throughout the week in a whole variety of ways. And sometimes we say, oh, we are so self-centered. Sometimes we say, oh, why is this happening to me? The answer sometimes, not always, but sometimes, is that God is speaking to you. And you're so slow to listen that He's having to speak to you in sometimes uncomfortable ways. Now, here in the book of Judges, the story makes plain that God, who has set His love upon us, and there's a thought, and God who has set such tremendous value upon us, His people, whom He has redeemed and reconciled to Himself by the broken body and shed blood of His own Son, Jesus Christ, God, first of all, is not prepared to allow spiritual carelessness and spiritual disobedience to go on without interference. And when it happened here in the book of Judges, time and time again, the same thing happened. He delivered them into the hand of his enemies. It wasn't just that certain things went wrong in their lives and in the life of the nation. God delivered them quite deliberately into the hand of their enemies until pain and misery worked repentance. Oh, you say you're making God out to be hard. No, I'm making God out to be tremendous in his love. And when he sees us spoiling our lives, it breaks his heart and he says, I cannot let that precious child of mine spoil his or her life and lose out in all the blessings that I'm planning and purposing for them. He's not hard. But I grant that his love that will not let us go sometimes seeks us through or by means of pain. But secondly, this God who has set his love upon us and who disciplines us, as I've just been describing, is the God who is willing to take back his people when they cried to him. Astonishing. What a God. I suppose there are times that, strictly speaking, I wouldn't have taken me back. But God did. And God does. He is a God who is willing to take back his people when they cry to him in their penitence of heart, and he raised up a deliverer. And we do well to consider, as we hurry on, the long suffering of God. Oh, the patience of God. Now, I know that in a book like the book of Judges, we mustn't make too much of the time sequence. But if I were to suggest to you to look back to chapter 3, at verse 8, it says at the end of that verse that the people of Israel served Cushan, their persecutor, 8 years. 8 long years. But look down to verse 11. After they had repented and were restored, so the land had rest for 40 years. I look down to verse 14. The people went adrift again, and God delivered them into the hand of their enemies, and they served the king of Moab 18 years. 8 the first time, 18 years. But look down to verse 30. And the land, after they had been redeemed and delivered yet again, the land had rest for 80 years. Chapter 4 at verse 3, the end of the verse. The wicked oppressor oppressed the people of Israel cruelly. That's an added word. Cruelly, for 20 years. And then after the end of the story of Deborah and Barak, at the end of chapter 5, the land had rest for 40 years. But we don't make too much of the time sequence, but we don't forget it. It's all very well to be reassured that God restores the backslider and heals the backslider. But sometimes you're adrift in a spiritual desert for a long, long time. But I was noticing as I prepared for this service at the end of chapter 3 that the land had rest for 80 years. And I was wondering just how things were in the life of Israel, the people of God, during these 80 years. No wars, no persecution, things reasonably smooth and fairly pleasant and economically stable and religiously fairly settled and all that kind of thing. The land had rest for 80 years. But these 80 years of rest lead up to chapters 4 and 5, when we discover the people of God once again in a mess. Now, think, these 80 years, what was going on in the life of Israel amongst the people of God? Well, from chapter 4, one thing is clear. That long spell of comparative peace and rest produced a character of tremendous faith and conviction and commitment and decisiveness. Deborah. These 80 years produced also a situation among the people of God in which there was a significant lack of men willing and ready to answer the call of God. Sometimes there are men, but neither willing nor ready to do the will and the work of God. The third thing that these 80 years produced in due time was this woman that we read about. She obviously knew a great deal about erecting and dismantling tents, and of course in these days that was the woman's job. When you arrived at a certain place, the men sat down and folded their arms and the woman set up camp. So she was pretty good with the pegs and the hammer. And these 80 years produced jailer Jael, this decisive, strong-minded woman who proved to be all that we mean by a freedom fighter in an occupied land that was terrorized by the cruelty of the oppressor. Yes, I know it's a grim story. I know that the commentary say, oh dear, 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 this is so contrary to the spirit of Jesus. But then you see, our land has never been overrun by terrible oppressors. And if you had to stand and watch while all the members of your family were taken out of the house and lined up against a wall and shot, and maybe all sorts of terrible things done to them before they were shot, you might turn out to be something like Jael or Jael. And these 80 years also produced, this is all in the story, I'm not making it up. These years also produced Barak. And what seems to be the most significant thing about this man, Barak, was his hesitation. Well, that's obvious. He was called to do the will and work of God, and Barak said to Deborah, if you go with me and hold my hand, I'll do it, but otherwise I'm not going to do it. What a man. A lot in the Bible about men being giving headship to women, but there's none of that here. The most significant thing about this man, Barak, is his hesitation. Human hesitation and spiritual hesitation. Oh, so I don't think I could do that when he was called. Here is a man marked by hesitation, a man marked by a tremendous sense of limitation. A man holding back and giving excuses when faced with the command of God for service, which command was backed up by the promise of God. Look at it in verses 6 and 7. Deborah sent and summoned Barak the son of Abinoam from Kedesh in Naphtali and said to him, the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go gather your men. Verse 7, and I will draw out Sisera, says God, with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand. Nothing uncertain about that, is there? As I pointed out earlier on, there is some justification, not complete justification, but some, for putting this into the form of a question, as the old authorized version does it. Deborah sent for Barak and says, look here, Barak, hasn't God already said to you, get up and go and do my will and do my work and deliver my people, and I will be with you to bless you and to give you victory. I wonder if there are people here tonight to whom God has already said, shouldn't you be in the mission field? Shouldn't you be in the ministry? Shouldn't you be in some particular, specific form of Christian service to which God has called you? That's what Deborah said to Barak. We mustn't, of course, be too critical of the man. We're not in a position. But when we get on in the book of Judges to chapter 6, you find Gideon saying exactly the same. Oh Lord, not me. I'm not capable of that kind of Christian service. And if you think back to the book of Exodus, you find Moses say, oh no, Lord, you've got it wrong. I'm not the man for this piece of service. And it does say it in the Bible. And Moses said, oh, I beseech you, Lord, send somebody else. You know the kind of thing that happens when you're asked to do a piece of Christian service in your own congregation. Oh, surely there's somebody else. Somebody older or somebody younger or somebody better qualified or somebody this or that. Now that's Barak. And Gideon, and Moses. And I suppose in a sense there is some illustration here of that declaration that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 where he says, not many of you were wise according to worldly standards, not many powerful, not many of noble birth, but God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak. Oh, you're maybe sitting here saying, oh yes, preacher, this is a good sermon, but you know, I'm not a strong person. Oh, you're the ideal candidate. God has chosen the weak. Oh, you say, Mr. Lord, I could never. Oh, don't you say, I could never. You underestimate God. There was a time in my life when I thought, well, I could never stand in a pulpit in front of a congregation. Guess I got it wrong. God has chosen what is weak in the world to shame the strong, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And you know, it's when you're aware of the fact that you're a pretty poor specimen, really. And then you discover that God has worked salvation through your life or your testimony or your preaching. And you get quite surprised. Well, it must have been God. It couldn't have been me. God has chosen the weak so that there will be no boasting. Now it's clear from this story in chapter 4 of Judges that Deborah, the woman, was the key figure. She was the woman who was spiritually decisive. And that will please those of a feminist disposition. The snag for such is that when you come to the New Testament and to the 11th chapter of the Epistle to the Hebrews, in reference to this story, it is Barak who is mentioned as the hero of faith, and Deborah doesn't even get her name on the list. What that signifies, I don't know, but I don't think we can possibly say that the Holy Spirit who inspired the scriptures was sufficient of a chauvinist to miss out Deborah and mention Barak instead. The truth of the matter is, you see, that this woman, Deborah, was of such spiritual caliber that she didn't need recognition. And I don't think she particularly wanted recognition. And that's always a snare in Christian service, you know. We like to be recognized. But recognized by whom? God recognizes. But he tends not to make a fuss. Deborah was the kind of woman who knew and was absolutely assured that she was in the will of God, doing the will of God, and she was a woman of character and capacity. Of that there is not the slightest doubt. Not only human character and capacity, but spiritual character and capacity and service. And compared to Deborah the woman, Barak the man was much more limited. He was much less sure of his faith. And his spiritual confidence had been undermined. You see, this is what happens when a nation drifts. And this is what happens when a congregation drifts. There are people who in the future have a part to play in God's work, who find that their spiritual confidence gets undermined. Not because they are backsliding, but because the congregation has grown complacent. There's a thought. There's a thought for the older generation of Christians in Sandyford. Are we providing the context and the atmosphere that will build up the spiritual confidence of those who have to carry the work when we are dead and gone? Barak had found his spiritual confidence undermined. And yet, he fought and he won. Now think of it this way. Some people, for example, find it comparatively easy, for example, to pray in a prayer meeting or to speak in public, get up on a platform or into a pulpit. They just find that kind of thing comes without a great deal of difficulty. But there are others. Let's put it into the context of the prayer meeting. Some find it quite easy. Others find it costly to the point of agony to pray aloud, almost as if they get frightened by the sound of their own voice. And not a few people here tonight know what it's been like to be aware of the fact that your hands are clenched and your knuckles are white as you speak to God in prayer in the context of your own prayer meeting. Now, who is the greater hero? The one who finds it easy? Oh, yes, I'll easily do that. Or the one who, because of what they are, find it costly beyond measure? I think Deborah would have been the first to recognize the worth of Barak. Yes, I know she was an honest enough woman and a godly enough woman to rebuke Barak and say, "Oh, Barak, yes, I'll go with you. I'll back you up to the hilt. I'll support you through the whole thing till the victory is won. But Barak, in the end of the day, you'll regret that you didn't go on your own. You'll miss out." It's easy to criticize Barak. But you know, as we go on in the book stories of the book of Judges, we will see more than once that overconfidence in spiritual things And some people are far too sure of their own spirituality. Overconfidence in spiritual things is every bit as great a problem as Barak had with his hesitation. We'll come eventually to the story of Samson. And Samson, here's a spiritual need. Here's a piece of spiritual. I'll go out and do it. I've done it before. I'll do it again. But he didn't know that God was no longer with him. God doesn't like spiritual pride. And God sometimes says, oh, well, if you're as sure of yourself as all that spiritually, I don't need to be with you. I'll just leave you to get on with it. And part of God's dealings with us, if we are to be useful in his service, is to bring home to us a very deep and a very profound sense of dependence on God. Didn't Jesus say to his own disciples, without me, you can do nothing? Now consider further this man Barak. He was sent for. It's not all that easy if somebody sends for you. He was sent for. He was summoned by, and he was challenged by Deborah, who said, God is saying to you, God is commanding you, go and gather the army of men and go and deal with this mighty oppressor of Israel. It's interesting to note that Deborah didn't want to lead the work herself. Oh, she could have done it. Quite sure of that. Oh, I could easily imagine Deborah barking out the orders to the army of men. Oh, yes, she could have done it, but she didn't want to. And here in this sixth verse, maybe this sermon is repetitive, I'm sorry. She sent and summoned Barak and said, the Lord, the God of Israel, commands you. Here is this woman aware of God's purposes, aware of God's timing, aware of God's calling. When it seemed that none of the men were alive to God. And I've no doubt at all that one aspect of this story is meant simply to shame the men of Israel who seem to have resigned themselves to the situation. You know the kind of thing, most congregations of at least a few of this kind who always say, it can't be done. Might as well leave it, it can't be done. Deborah knew that it could be done. And she sent for Barak and repeated to him the call and the command of God. And if you were following the chapter carefully, you'll have seen in the third verse a very significant element in the situation. The people of Israel cried to the Lord. There was what we would call the beginning of an awakening. The beginning of a desire for things to be put right in relation to God. The cry of the people was there. I believe the stirring of the Spirit of God was there. Certainly the Spirit of God stirred the heart of Deborah, and in measure the Spirit of God was stirring the cold, reluctant heart of Barak. So the cry of the people was there, the stirring of the Spirit of God was there, the call of God was there. But it wasn't being heard. Or if it was being heard, it wasn't being answered. And Deborah summoned Barak and spoke to him and said to him, God calls you to service. put it into slightly different language. Makes me feel that Deborah was very aware that there could have been rather an unfortunate reaction. It's the kind of thing, for example, when a minister goes to someone and says to them, shouldn't you be, well, singing in the choir to lead the praise, or teaching in Sunday school, or helping in the youth clubs, or visiting some of the old people who haven't anybody coming in through their door from one weekend to the other? Oh, we could go on, and shouldn't you? This is what Deborah said to Barak. Shouldn't you be doing this? How would you react if I came and said some of these things to you personally after the service? You might say, oh, I've plenty of other things to... That's not the point. This is your congregation. This is where you're being fed by God, where you're being prayed for, where you're being upheld by the fellowship and the commitment and the prayers of other people. Now the interesting thing is, and remember it's in a Jewish setting here, and women weren't supposed to boss men in the Jewish situation. When Deborah came to Barak and said, shouldn't you be leading the people of God, the army of God, to break the yoke of the oppressor? There was no resentment on the part of Barak. And when Deborah said, the Lord, the God of Israel, command you, go gather your men, and God says, I will be with you and I will give you victory. Barak didn't resent it. Oh, you say he was unwilling. No, I'm not sure that he was unwilling. I think he was just afraid. The thought almost petrified me. God called you to service, said Deborah to Barak. And if you are willing, God will give you an army of 10,000. And God will give you victory, and God promises his presence and his blessing. Are you willing? And it is at this point at verse 8 in our story that Barak said, if you will go with me, I will go, but if you will not go with me, I will not go. Barak at that point confessed he had lost his spiritual drive. He was really saying, well, you know, Deborah, I've seen the day that I could have done this kind of thing, but not now. And he admitted that he had lost his spiritual drive. He had lost his spiritual assurance. He had gone the way of the generality of the people of Israel. And as a result, he was drained of spiritual life. But he was still able to recognize that God was with Deborah. And it's always a good sign when you recognize that it is evident that God is with some people. And he said to her, go with me. And I'll go, but if not, I won't go. And she said, all right, she said, I'll go. But in the end, you'll be sorry. It seems as if Barak at that point lost his chance to go out and redeem his manliness in the things of God. But again, I say to you, hesitate before you criticize Barak. Because it is not easy to go first. It's not easy to go out front and lead a people in the will and work of God. It's not easy to go ahead and blaze the trail and tackle situations of immense difficulty in a day of apostasy when the atmosphere is against spiritual commitment. Oh, you say, preacher, but, well, he was weak. Well, if you want to say that, let me ask you a question. Presumably you're saying that Barak was weak because you feel you're a bit stronger than that. Tell me this. Do you take a stand for Jesus at your work? And perhaps more demandingly at the places where you play? Do you have a witness to Jesus? Do you commit yourself when there is manifestly spiritual leadership? Or do you stand back and let others do the work? Oh, you don't have to answer me. It's none of my business. But you answer him. This is the story of Barak. But Barak went. I think I'm beginning to have a real respect for Barak. He went. And nobody knows what it cost him. Yes, he asked Deborah to go with him, but there's nothing wrong in asking for the support and the encouragement of those who manifestly know their God and are walking with God, and that support was given. And all of us need to recognize that we need support and we need partnership, and we need not only to give it, we need to ask it. Although I recognize that there are times that we ask for spiritual support and we don't get it. I know lots of ministers up and down the country would say amen to that. And when it is obvious that God is with someone, in the way that God is not with you, then listen to that person, because they'll do you good. And right through the story, we'll see more of this next Sunday evening. Deborah was decisive. Verse 14, Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is the day." It would appear, we'll see this from chapter 5, that although by and large the rainy season was past, there were still times when you got a tremendous cloudburst up in the foothills. And in no time at all, I think, is it the River Kishon, I'm not quite sure, the torrent would come rushing down and overflow the banks. And the whole of the plain started to get rather soggy. And that's where Sisera had all his tanks. And they got stuck. Oh yes, Deborah was decisive. "Up," she said, "this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go?" Oh, here's a... Oh, I'll confess, it's very careless sometimes the way I read the Bible. That's why I couldn't pronounce one of the big names. I missed out half of it earlier on. I don't know that I really noticed. Deborah said, "Up, this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you?" Oh, what a way to go into next week. Does not the Lord go out before you? So Barak went. I'm not going to say much about the last bit of the story. But at the end, in verse 22... Barak has it rubbed into him that just as it was a woman who started the work, so it was a woman who finished the work. as I said at the beginning of the sermon, did Barak have regrets? Did Barak, pondering it all, say to himself, I'm not the man I could have been, and I'm not the servant of God that I could have been? I took the trouble yesterday to look up Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and miseries. On such a full sea we are now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures. There is a tide. Ah, yes, and there's a time. And there's a time for men and women here tonight to say, this word has been for me. I'm not the man or woman that I could have. Yes, I've served the Lord, but I'm not the man or the woman that I could have been. We'll sing in just a moment about all the work the Lord has for us to do. But oh, how sad if we face it like Barak. I suppose in some ways all this is the story of lost opportunity. And I just wonder if in the past there was some point at which Barak went astray from God. Or whether it was just a gradual crowding of his life which eased God to the sidelines. You see it sometimes with people's careers. You see it sometimes when Christians get married and the edge just goes off their spiritual commitment. You see it sometimes in family or with hobbies. You see it sometimes in Christians whose spiritual potential is never realized. And so we leave Barak tonight. Oh, say that he was weak if you want to say that kind of thing about him. But God's call came to Barak. However it came about that he was as weak as he was, I do not know. But God's call came to him. And God's call carries God's promise, and God's promise carries God's power. And because of that, the possibilities